From PRI Public Radio International, I'm Cornell West, and this is Smiley and West. Brother Tavis is away on assignment this week. He's recording an upcoming television series on PBS entitled Education Under Arrest. It's about school-to-prison pipeline. Too many of our precious young brothers and sisters of all colors, but especially the chocolate ones, they tend to be on this pipeline. Tavis is fighting it. Can't wait to see that. Such an important subject to put in the spotlight. But before he went on assignment, Brother Tavis and I were able to record a conversation with actor George Takei. He's building on his legacy with a new musical about U.S. concentration camps that confined our precious Japanese brothers and sisters during World War II, including George himself. It's a powerful production, powerful conversation later in the program. But first, we are joined this week with my dear brother, Bob Ovechkin. He is the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. He is a legendary freedom fighter. He's a long-distance runner. He's one of the few coming out of the 60s who never sold out. He never caved in. He never gave up. Held on to his forging of a rigorous scientific analysis of the objective realities that are driven by a revolutionary love, because he has such a deep love for poor people, oppressed people all around the world. And whether you agree or disagree with our brother, one thing you cannot deny, that he is the real thing. No doubt about it. Brothers, the blessing to have you. Say hello to the audience.
Hello, and thank you very much for that introduction.
No, I'm just telling the truth. So just quickly, let's begin with your reading of our historical moment.
Well, you talked about some of it. I mean, even recent history with the Japanese, the concentration camps and turn Japanese, and today the mass incarceration of youth from the inner cities, of black and brown youth in particular, the little talked about phenomenon of like masses of women in the inner cities being evicted. There's a lot of talk also about people being foreclosed in their homes, but poor women being evicted in growing numbers, as well as growing numbers of poor women going into prison. As the United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world in general, and of women in particular. Then there are the wars, there's the poverty, there's the economic crisis. You know, and we could go, and the repression in general, we could go on and on. This is the kind of world we're faced with, where, for example, 10 million children die every year in the third world of malnutrition and preventable disease. 10 million children every year, more than the population of the biggest city in the United States, for example. And this is the this is the reality that we're dealing with. And the reality is not only that this is horrific, but that is totally unnecessary. We live in a world of tremendous abundance, but what we have is the private appropriation by a few of this great wealth that's produced by many, and it doesn't go to the benefit of the many. So we need a revolution to radically change this society, but not just this society, the whole world. And we have to change, in fact, the way in which this society, as much as it oppresses people here, the ruling class of the society feasts off the rest of the world and enriches itself on that basis under even worse conditions than what the worst face here. So this is where we stand, and there, you know, we're up against powerful forces, people that rule this country. I mean, anybody who doesn't recognize how powerful they are doesn't deserve to be taken seriously. Let's just say that straight up. But they're also sitting on top of a system that's erupting underneath them, a system that's riddled with contradictions economically. Politically, they claim that there's liberty and justice for all, but we know that's not true. We know there's profound and widespread injustice. And these contradictions are the basis for how a movement to actually rid humanity of this system can be built.
No, indeed. As you know, I've had a wonderful conversation with Brother Carl Dix.
Right.
Just calling for stop and frisk, Brother Carl throwing down, and Brother Lennon and Danny. Oh, Lord, yes. I mean, one distinctive feature of revolutionary communists in the party that you are head of, founder of, is that they tend to accent white supremacy. They tend to accent poor people and their dignity and capacity to change things, but also a scientific analysis of what they are up against. Now, could you tell us just very briefly your conception of revolution vis-a-vis, let's say, Martin Luther King, who called for revolution, wanted a transfer of power from oligarchs to everyday people, recognizing the horror, the misery, the nightmare, but this is important for me, of course, because I'm a revolutionary Christian, you're a revolutionary communist. Could you give us the difference in your understanding?
Yeah, well, let me just add first before I get into that, let's not forget also, and I know you don't, about male supremacy. And,
Lord,
one of the great horrors in this world today is the, you know, enslavement of young girls and women in the millions all over the world, including right in this country and right down the street from wherever people are in sexual slavery, as well as other horrific forms of oppression of women and gay people and others in the society, just to get the whole picture, flesh it out. And I know you agree with me on that.
Absolutely.
But to speak to the difference in essence is, first of all, Martin Luther King called for a nonviolent change, or the revolution that, when he used the word revolution, it was an idea of change that would come about within the existing framework, even if it meant radical change. But what we're talking about is actually breaking the hold of those who rule the society and who prey on the masses of people here and around the world, breaking the hold of their institutions of violent repression over the masses of people. Now, we're not talking about running out and being crazy and trying to do this when there's not a basis for it. In order to have a revolution, you have to have millions and ultimately tens of millions of people who are convinced of the need for that revolution, who are not only fed up and don't want to live another day in this kind of way, but are convinced that there's a radically different way that they could live and that human beings could interrelate and the society and the world could be. And when you get to that point, which is what we're working to bring into being, that kind of consciousness and that kind of political movement and resistance against the crimes of this system, when you get to that point, then you have to be able to deal with the fact that violent repression is going to be brought down on you. These people are not going to step aside. They're not going to say, oh, you're right. You know, we've committed horrible crimes all around the world. We've done terrible things to people. We're going to stop and step aside so you can build a better world. No, they're going to try to violently crush any organized force and broader mass of people who are trying to bring about that change. And you're going to have to deal with their attempts to violently crush it. You're going to have to defeat that. You're going to have to defeat their institutions and their organs of violent repression against people, and you're going to have to dismantle them and replace them with revolutionary institutions that actually serve the radicalization of society in the interests of the great majority of people in the world, and ultimately serving the emancipation of humanity as a whole from this whole horror that we've been living under.
You know, we just had the first debate, and it was a sad spectacle to see the two candidates unable to really engage any of the real issues affecting poor people and working people. Why do you think American society, American culture has been so resistant to the kind of awakening that would lead poor and working people to straighten their backs up, organize, and engage in forms of social activism and resistance that would fundamentally change a society?
Well, I think the people that are vying to be the chief executive and commander-in-chief of this system and its armed forces are trying to enforce the very system and maintain by force the very system that causes all the things that you were just mentioning and that people need to be organized to stand up against, resist, fight against, and eventually get rid of through revolution. So I think that explains why they talk the way they do and about what they talk about, because their interests are completely different from, but not just different, they're completely opposed to the interests of the great majority of people in this society, and especially those they have their boot on most viciously. So that's one thing. I also wanted to go back, though, not to miss an important element of the previous question you asked, sort of, if you will, the philosophical dimension. What's the difference between a Christian revolutionary and a communist revolutionary?
Yeah.
I know that we want to talk about that. You know, and the difference is that communism proceeds on a scientific basis of actually probing, investigating, and summing up what's learned from reality and then testing what conclusions you draw from that against reality, so that we can proceed from what is actually arises in reality and what can be verified in reality. And that's our, you know, that's our basic scientific approach. My belief in revolution and our party's firm foundation and the principles of making revolution is not grounded in the idea that, well, it would just be morally right, although we're profoundly convinced it is morally right, or not just that it would be nicer if the world could be this way, but actually a concrete analysis which leads us to understand in the full dimensions what a horror the world is for the great majority of humanity. If you just think about those 10 million children in the third world, it's just one, you know, concentration of that. What a horror it is, but on the other hand, that it does not have to be this way. And so that we don't base it on, you know, what you've referred to as a prophetic tradition or, you know, religious belief. Right. We base it on a scientific belief, even though it also includes an ethical or moral dimension, that we don't just understand the world as a horror. We also feel that it's intolerable, but we also ground that in a scientific understanding that it does not have to be this way. And the more that you understand scientifically that it does not have to be this way, the more outraged you are by the fact that it continues to be this way and that there are forces who insist upon and use violence to maintain this system and with all the consequences that means for the great majority of people.
No, indeed, indeed, because I know the audience is titillated to have such a revolutionary atheist with a revolutionary Christian and still have overlap in terms of our love for poor people, and not only that, but a willingness, both of us, to live and die for the cause of trying to change the world in the interest of oppressed people of those friends for known call the wretched of the earth. But it's so difficult to adjudicate the atheism and the God talk in the sense of that. Will there ever be a kind of final agreement between us? Well, that's difficult to envision because it looks like I'm so rooted in my own understanding of the prophetic tradition and rooted in my own conception of God's love that leads me to want to live and die for poor folk. And yet your life has been exemplary in willingness to pay cost and price and persist and prevail in trying to disclose certain truths objectively and still sustain what I call a revolutionary love for poor people. Is that a fair characterization when I say you have a revolutionary love for poor people?
Well, I think that's part of it, definitely. If you don't have those kind of, you know, if you don't have those kind of feelings, just put it simply, then you cannot be a revolutionary. You cannot be a communist. If you're not outraged at what poor people and people broadly in the world are put through, you know, if that doesn't cause your blood to boil, to put it that way, then you could never be a revolutionary. So in that sense, definitely yes. Mm-hmm. And if you don't burn with a desire to put an end to that and bring something much better into being, especially when you see that it's possible, then you have absolutely no right to talk about being a revolutionary.
See, that's the kind of fire I'm talking about, and I love that fire. You go back to Black Panther Party. You go back to working with the early Huey Newton. You go back to working with the Revolutionary Union in the Bay Area. You have a long, long, rich history, and yet you've been able to sustain it, to keep alive both your hope as well as your imagination, scientific analysis, that wonderful core with a lot of elasticity, that heart that still has a flexibility, as it were. How do you account for Brother Bob Ovakian still being part of this revolutionary love train?
Well, we were talking about this before. If you see the world the way it is and you draw the conclusion you have to draw from being willing to look straight face at the world the way it is, and you recognize that it has not gotten better for the great majority of humanity, it continues to get worse. You know, people are uprooted from one place and desperately searching all over the earth for a way to make a livelihood, trying to go from one country to another just in order to live. You know, they're subjected to wars, they're subjected to environmental destruction, they're subjected to the horror of their own kids being shot down on the street by the police in the hundreds every year in this country. You know, if you see all that, then, and you know that it doesn't have to be that way. Look at all the abundance there is in the world. It's been, in the, you know, the technology, the interconnectedness of people, which could lead to a rich life, and I don't mean financially.
Right.
I mean in what you would call spiritual sense.
Yes.
I mean
yes.
In the enrichment of life, the quality of people's lives, you know, both their material needs, but their intellectual and cultural needs could be met on a whole other level, and yet they're being suffocated and strangled under this system. Why would you want to live under this any longer? Why would you not want to keep working and struggling? And yes, why would you not have an open mind to learn from anyone and anything you could learn from in order to be able to fight better to do this? That's the bedrock of everything. That's, you know, that's where I live, if you want to put it that way, because I've seen the horror, and I've also seen the fact that it doesn't have to be this way. There have been previous, you know, great breakthroughs that are made in Soviet Union and China to build a whole new socialist society to be on the road of doing away with these things, and they were turned back and defeated So we've had to study very deeply the lessons to learn how to do better, and you know, both in fighting, but also in when we get to the stage where we have a new society, how to actually lead that society in an even better way so we can stay on the road and defeat the attempts to crush what we brought into being. So all that goes into it. Why, you know, why would you want to settle for anything less once you see on the one hand what the horror is, but also on the other hand what the possibility for something much different and truly beautiful really is?
I think Americans oftentimes overlook the degree to which communists in our past, though not in any way a large majority, there's always been a small minority of communists in America, but they've played a very important role in struggles against injustice, struggles against white supremacy, male supremacy, struggles against capitalism, struggles against homophobia. We think in the civil rights movement, there are a number of communists that played an important role, going back to the trade union movement. What is the role of revolutionary communists at this particular moment, a kind of an Occupy moment, even though the Occupy movement needs to bounce back? What is the role of communists, and how will revolutionary communists attempt to provide some kind of vision and analysis?
Well, we have a slogan that sort of encapsulates how we approach building a movement for revolution, which is fight the power and transform the people for revolution. And all three parts of that are important. First of all, if people don't rise up against their oppression, if they're just beaten down continually, then they're never going to be able to actually bring a new world into being, and they're never going to be able even to think about the big questions that we're discussing right here of could the world be a different way? Why is it the way it is, and is there a possibility for it to be radically different and better? So people need to be led, and they need to rise up and fight back against the many ways in which people are oppressed, and we need to unite with people when they do rise up. And we need to, at the same time, when we get to transform the people, that means transform the thinking, the consciousness of the people, so they see not just the need to resist this or that outrage, but they see the interconnection of all these different things that outrage people and people rise up against, and they see how they're all rooted in the same capitalist imperialist system and the way that it works and the way that it has to work and the way that it crushes people in working the way it does. And they begin to see at the same time the possibility of a radically different world, because they come to understand that while this system works this way, there is a basis for a whole different kind of system that works on different bases that put the interests of the people forefront and fundamentally, you know, as the basis for what people are doing. So that's transforming the people. It's transforming their thinking, transforming how they relate to each other, transforming what they think is possible, raising their heads so that they can think about the things that normally they're pushed down from even being able to think about. And then, for what? For revolution, because if people don't rise up and fight back, they'll be crushed. But if they just rise up and continually and fight back, they're going to be still trapped in the same situation they're in. I mean, you know, I've said this before, if I were a preacher, you know, and I were looking at all the things going on in the world, you know, just how many times do you have to read about another family whose, you know, whose son or daughter is shot down by the police, and all the tears that flow and the anguish that flows on the basis of that? How many times do you have a Romarly Graham or a Manuel Diaz out in California, or a Sean Bell or Oscar Grant? How many times do you have that go on? You know, and I don't want to be here, you know, or have someone else be here 30 years from now talking about what we're going to do about the fact that police are shooting people down on the streets in the hundreds every year and subjecting millions of youth to mass incarceration, or women to mass enslavement, or denying them the right to abortion or birth control. I don't want to see a world in which 30 or 40 years from now, we're going over the same outrages talking about what are we going to do about it. We need to move beyond that, so we need a revolution to get to where we can move beyond it.
Now, one of the fascinating features of the Revolutionary Communist Party is the stress on the arts, music, and on poetry. You've written quite powerfully about the role of imagination. And actually, you put out a little hip-hop single, too. I forget what I remember that as well, come to think of it. But what is the role of the arts when it comes to social activism, struggle, and revolutionary engagement with the world?
Anyway, did I make my point about the preacher?
The
preacher would say, "How long, O Lord?" But I don't want to keep having to say that, even without the O Lord. I don't want to.
But some preachers say, "How long, O Lord, Lord? I am sent to do something about it.
Okay, there we are.
And we meet in the streets with some revolutionary communists, some anarchists, right, some progressives, and others. But in terms of the arts, though, I want
yeah,
to make
right.
That,
I just absolutely. Wanted to make yeah, that clear that. We do have that unity, that we don't yes. want to have to keep saying how long, even if some of us say, oh, Lord, and some of us don't.
That's right.
That's where we meet, that we don't want to have to keep saying that.
That's exactly
now, right. As for the point about, so I just wanted to make that clear. But as far as the point about the arts, yes, because people... You know, again, I'll invoke your tradition. People do not live by bread alone.
That's right. That's
you know, people need cultural and intellectual sustenance
yes.
as well as material sustenance. And people constantly produce art of one kind or another. The question is, what is going to be the content of that and what is it going to serve? But also, how do we approach different people within different traditions or different fields of art, whether it's painting or music or other things, how do we understand what they're trying to do, and how do we try to give life to things in such a way that it all can contribute to the building up the basis to actually make a revolution and then to actually have a new society in which culture and art can flourish on a whole other level in many diverse expressions. There isn't just one form of art that should be promoted, and there isn't just art that's political in the more direct and explicit sense that's important. That kind of art, which calls people, you know, to the barricades, to the political struggle, so to speak, you know, using barricades right. metaphorically. Now, let's not distort right. what's being said here.
That's right.
You
that's
know, at
right.
this point, we're talking about metaphorically, but out in the streets, fighting back against the oppression, the art that calls people forward to do that is very important. But there are also many other forms of art, you know, that are more quote-unquote abstract, if you will, or, you know, jazz or other things, which yeah. give expression to a mood or a sentiment or a feeling, you know, which also have to be, you know, embraced as part of what we're doing. Now, if they have a reactionary content, if they call on people to do things that are harmful to the masses of people, or they create a mood that depresses people and makes them feel that they can't do anything to change their conditions, then we have to get into some struggle about that and say, no, let's have some art and culture. Let's not, you know, let's have hip-hop, but let's not have hip-hop that talks about bitches. Oh, I don't know.
No, that's all
right. Say that on the radio.
The B word, that's right. No, that's fine.
Okay, bitches and hoes, you know, and right. puts women down and just says, I'm going to get mine and I don't care what happens to anybody else, and if I have to step on or even shoot other people to get rich, let's do that, and I'm just going to promote all kinds of backward nonsense. Let's not have that. Let's have more fight to power, and let's have more let's get rid of oppression, not let's get ours out of this oppression. Not let's get in on it, but let's get rid of it. But, you know, so there has to be struggle about art, but also you have to allow art to flourish and develop. You can't, you know, try to squeeze it, squeeze the life out of it. You can't try to take things as soon as they come forth and put some kind of litmus test to them to see if they measure up in some sort of, you know, abstract and dogmatic sense. You have to have a lot of flourishing of art and culture. This is one of the key things of the new synthesis of communism that I've been bringing forward, that we need to give a lot of emphasis to giving life to these different things, and then we can sift through them. And not just a few of us, but masses of people can sift through them to see what it is that actually inspires them toward things that would really be positive, and what is it they need to discard because it actually leads them away from where they need to go. There are a lot of different, you know, yes, I did produce something all played out.
It was a nice single. Now.
But that was just my giving vent, you know, giving expression, not vent, but giving expression to my outrage at a lot of things that go on that get over here, the hypocrisy of the ruling class of this country, and also the backward stuff among the masses of people, which, yes, does need to be called out. If, you know, we have a saying too, if people are talking, well, I'm going to use the R-rated version here. If people are talking nonsense, you know, they need to be called out for it.
Yeah,
you know, and that's
yeah.
part of what I was doing there. But, you know, look, I'm not a, you know, a highly developed, you know, hip-hop artist. But there are lots of highly developed hip-hop artists. And that's why I say we need more of them doing things that will contribute to the struggle to get rid of oppression in many different forms. It doesn't have to be, let's get rid of oppression, you know, time to stop all the depression. It doesn't have to be like that. But it can be, a lot of different forms in which people, you know, are creating the kind of atmosphere and feeling that inspires people to better things and to stand up and fight back and eventually to make revolution.
No, it's one of the reasons why we talk about Lupe Fiasco and Brother Ali and Erykah Badu and some of the other young artists affecting the generation to come, as it were. Two quick questions. One, of course, is the role of the new Jim Crow, the prison industrial complex, and the fact that so many of revolutionary communists I know zero in on the deeply racist and unjust criminal justice system. And prisoners themselves seem to be more and more open to at least a broader analysis of the context in which they find themselves. Is this part of the role of trying to engage in transformation society, zeroing in on the prison industrial complex, making sure, like with Michelle Alexander, we have a public discussion about the new Jim Crow?
Well, yes. Look, first of all, once again, to go to the moral dimension, if you will, this is, yes, you know, and the political dimension where they're joined. This is a tremendous outrage. I mean, and I think Michelle Alexander has done a tremendous service by systematizing an understanding of what, you know, a huge phenomenon this is and what social role it plays, that this is the new Jim Crow. This is the new segregation and repression directed against black people and also Latinos. But it's part of the whole history of the oppression of black people in this country. And it's an outrage, and it needs to be taken on. There needs to be a massive struggle developed against this, in which thousands and ultimately millions of people, and not just black and Latino people, but people everywhere who care about justice and ending injustice, need to become part of this. And from our point of view, we approach this as understanding that this is something very, it gets to something very basic about the whole history of this country and the whole nature of the system in this country, the oppression of black people. And this, so we've taken this up, this new Jim Crow, this mass incarceration. I mean, look what they're doing to the youth. You know, I mean, millions and millions of them being marched off to prison, you know, and being given jackets from the time they're young kids, you know, being rolled up on, stopped and frisked. Four or five are hanging out on the street corner in L.A., and they constitute a gang, which therefore is automatically stripped of its rights. You know, all this is, if this were going on in any other country, everybody would say, what a horrific country that is that does something like that to a whole section of people, particularly the youth. So this has to be taken on. From our point of view, this gets to the very nature of this system, and it's one of the fundamental reasons why this system needs to be swept aside. And we've also taken up a mass struggle against the degradation of women in some of the main forms in which patriarchal and male supremacist oppression is coming down on women, and in the just rampant and vicious and mainstreaming of pornography that's going on, and sexual violence against women, as well as the attacks, the constant incessant attacks, which people like Obama and others are doing nothing to counter, by the way, against the right of women to reproductive freedom, even to have the right to abortion or even birth control in order to be able to determine whether they themselves are going to have children, and if so, when and under what conditions. So this is another thing that gets, it's a mass outrage. There's not enough awareness of it, and there's not enough struggle around it in both these two things. The mass incarceration and the mass degradation of women in these forms, there is not enough awareness, which we need to go out and change, and there's not the kind of mass struggle that there would be and there should be and would be if people understood what is actually going on and what it really represents. And from our point of view, all this is part of building toward getting rid of this system, because all this is rooted in and fundamental to this system. The oppression of black people and other people of color, the oppression of women, you cannot get rid of that under this system, and we need to be rid of it.
Well, I wish we had 2 hours just to be able to sustain this conversation, because I know, again, the internationalism of your vision and of the Revolutionary Communist Party's vision is crucial. So the issues of drones that we highlight, of course, on this show, bombs dropped on innocent people, connected to the American empire, connected to imperial policies abroad on the one hand, but also, of course, the Wall Street oligarchs still control of the economy here on the other. Question that liberals often ask for the kind of conversation we have, which is, does America have the capacity for the kind of revolution that you're calling for? Wouldn't there first be a fascist revolution before there's a communist revolution? As I said, there's more right-wing of soil in the country. So if you actually had a clash, it'd be more fascists than communists, and therefore the liberals say you better hold on for the middle ground because we're the only thing standing between poor people and fascism. What do you say to such a
view? Well, I think there, on the one hand, that is a real danger.
Yes.
And there is a real fascist movement in this country, and it has connections up to the highest levels of government in in the Republican Party. It has backing from powerful forces within the ruling class of this country. So that's a real thing and shouldn't be ignored or underestimated. But the answer to it is not to try to, quote-unquote, hold on to the middle ground, because the middle ground keeps getting shifted and dragged more and more to the right, so that the liberals start finding themselves compromising more and more with fascism in order to hold off fascism. And that is a recipe or a formula for disaster. What has to happen is we have to bring forward the force of people who suffer the most under this system and have the most reason to rise up against it, but also other people throughout the middle class and others, including the students, including the people in the intelligentsia, professionals and others, who may not yet be convinced of the need for revolution or may not feel that their life calls out for it in the same urgent way that people on the bottom of this society who catch hell, if you I want to use another metaphor like that, catch hell every day.
That's Malcolm. That's Malcolm X right there.
Right, that is. I openly acknowledge my debt to Malcolm on that one.
Prophetic Muslim. Yeah, no, right here.
Yeah, I openly acknowledge that debt, yes. Catch hell every day under the system.
That's right.
You know, there's also people in the middle class who may not be in that position, but who are outraged by a lot of the injustices and the things you're talking about, the wars, the environmental destruction, the use of the drones, which could kill, hundreds, if not thousands of civilians already in countries, on different continents already now. The bombing of Libya, which more people should have been outraged by, the U.S. and NATO bombing of Libya. But, the wars that have continued in Afghanistan and other places, there are many people who are upset about these things. But as long as they hold on to the notion that we better not say a peep about them because we might encourage the fascists, they're just going to allow things to get worse and worse. And then we could find ourselves in a situation where the form of rule over the people takes on an overtly and directly terroristic, fascistic form. But what's going on? Two things. We're not going to stop that by conciliating with it and by trying to rely on other sections of the ruling class, which are not going to resist it in the way it needs to be resisted, because they are representatives of the same system, and they have to work out their compromises with these fascist forces who are also part of the ruling structure. And second of all, the answer to it is revolution. The answer is not trying to preserve this system in some kind of form that would be a little less horrible than fascism.
Mm-hmm. Which groups in American society do you think would be most open to your message of revolutionary change?
Look, we have to look, who are the people, and again, we'll invoke Malcolm, who are the people who are catching hell the hardest ways under this system every day? The people, not in the more bourgeois strata, but the basic masses of people among black people, Latinos, and others in the inner city, and other poor people in the country, and people who have had a better life or have had a little bit higher standard of living, maybe unionized workers, who are now being driven down, and losing some of that. But the basic bedrock of revolution, as we say it, are the people who are, have the foot on them the hardest, and who are in conditions of poverty and brutality as a result of the workings of the system and as a result of how the system is enforced over them. Those are the people who have the most fundamental and driving interest in changing things radically, and they just need to be convinced of the possibility of doing that, and that's what we're working to do. And they need to they need to have their consciousness transformed to see the full picture of this system and its horrors, not just what it does to them, but what it does to people in all different parts of society, and even worse, to people in other parts of the world, especially what's called the third world. But that's going to be the bedrock and driving force. And then on that basis, we have to go out and unite much broader forces, as I said earlier, among the students, among the intelligentsia more generally, among the middle class, certainly among women who are oppressed under this system, among gay people and others who are oppressed under this system. We have to go out and build what we call a broad united front, but under the leadership of the proletariat, that is the exploited class in this society on whose backs the whole system is built.
Yes, indeed. Negro National Anthem, Lift Every Voice. That is the voice of my dear brother, legendary leftist, legendary lover of poor and oppressed people, legendary chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, Bob Ovakian. Thank you so very much. I hope you have unsettled many in our audience, because we need to hear voices from across the board wrestling with the issues of poverty, militarism, empire, male supremacy, homophobia, anti-Semitism, anti-Arab, anti-Islamic sensibility. Why? Because of a love of humanity. Thank you so very much, my brother.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
We are so blessed to have our dear brother George Takei. He joins us from KPBS in San Diego. George, an honor to have you. You are one of the living legends, though, brother. Going back
to Star Trek,
from theater and film. You've been an activist with the American Civil Liberties Union. You even ran for city council in Los Angeles. You fuse the political and the artistic at such a magnificent level. But what a blessing to have you. You're there in San Diego for your magnificent play, Allegiance, which is premiering this month, right?
Yes. Well, we opened last week at the Old Globe Theater here in San Diego in beautiful Balboa Park. And it's a pleasure to be talking with both of you.
And maybe we should start first with this play before we even get into your life and history. But this is a play about the internment, the concentration camps of our precious Japanese brothers and sisters during World War II.
It
and
is a groundbreaking musical.
Groundbreaking, exactly.
First time that this subject, the internment of American citizens of Japanese ancestry, being incarcerated simply because we happen to look like the people that bombed Pearl Harbor, as a musical bound for Broadway. It is going to be a landmark in American theater.
Why a musical, George?
Well, I was initially planning on making the first third of my autobiography as a television drama, but just by chance, prophetically, in a Broadway theater, we met someone who recognized my voice, and we started a conversation, and he turned out to be the composer-lyricist of Allegiance, a very gifted composer-lyricist, and his business partner, Lorenzo Tione, who also is a book writer. We just happened to meet in a Broadway theater, and during an intermission conversation, I mentioned my childhood in two American internment camps, and from that sprang what's now turned into a glorious musical, deeply moving and profoundly important for America.
Tell me, George, though, when I ask why a musical, what I'm really getting at is how you think the story, the narrative that's being told vis-a-vis the play, works better as a musical as opposed to some other form of theater.
Well, as I said, I initially thought of making my story a drama for television. But Jay Kuo, the composer-lyricist, said, via music, you can hit people more profoundly through the heart and then to the mind. And being a musical theater fan, I certainly understood that. But I didn't know what kind of musician he was. But were from San Francisco, we're from Los Angeles. But I maintained an email communication with Jay. And 2 weeks after we got back from New York, he mailed me a song that he'd written titled Allegiance, about a man confronted by the loyalty questionnaire after a year of imprisonment and his anguish, his conflict as an American and as a father. And this song was so powerful and so moving. I literally was sobbing at my computer. That's when I was convinced that he is a wonderful, amazing musician, able to communicate so much via music. It is more powerful. And you can also compress and condense and make much denser a human experience via music.
I know, Doc, and I want to hear about your childhood. Before you tell us about your childhood in these internment camps, or as they called them, relocation centers.
That was a euphemism.
Yeah, exactly.
I was just not telling the truth.
Yeah, exactly. Tell us, firstly, why the title Allegiance? I think I get it, but I want to hear it from you. Why the title Allegiance? And then after that, tell us about your childhood and what people are going to get when they see the play.
Well, simply because of who we were, who we looked like, our loyalty and our citizenship was challenged. When Pearl Harbor was bombed, young Japanese-American men and women rushed to their hometown recruitment centers to volunteer to serve in the military. They were denied service and labeled enemy non-alien. It was bad enough to be called an enemy, but it was compounded by the term non-alien. What is that? That's a citizen defined in the negative. They even took the word citizen away from us, simply because of our ancestry, how we looked. And then they imprisoned us. And after a year of imprisonment, the government realized that there's a wartime manpower shortage, and here were all these people that we had accused of being potential spies, saboteurs, fifth columnists. And how do we tap that manpower? It was our allegiance that they wanted to ascertain. And so they came down with what was called that notorious loyalty questionnaire. They wanted to get certain answers. And this loyalty questionnaire had to be responded to by every internee over the age of 17. Whether you were an 87-year-old immigrant lady or a 17-year-old young man. Question 27 asked, will you bear arms to defend the United States of America? Now, can you imagine an 87-year-old immigrant lady being asked to bear arms to defend the United States? It was preposterous. Mm. Question 28 was one sentence with two different ideas, opposing ideas. It asked, will you swear your loyalty to the United States of America and forswear your loyalty to the Emperor of Japan? Now, to an American citizen, it was offensive for the government to assume that we have an existing loyalty to the Emperor simply because of our ancestry. Mm-hmm. It was offensive. I mean, the word forswear assumes that there is an inborn existing loyalty. So if you answered no, meaning I don't have a loyalty to the Emperor to forswear, you were also saying no to the first part of that same sentence. Will you swear your loyalty to the United States? If you answered yes, meaning you will swear your loyalty to the United States, you were then fessing up that you had been loyal to the Emperor, thus justifying the internment. It was our allegiance that was challenged by the whole internment, the imprisonment itself, and after a year of imprisonment, that offensive, despicable loyalty questionnaire. And the amazing thing is, so many thousands of young men and women bit the bullet, swallowed their pride, and answered those questions the way the government wanted us to answer them, and went from behind those barbed wire fences, putting on the same uniform as that of the sentries guarding over us, and served in the United States military in a segregated all-Japanese-American unit, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. And these young men were sent to Europe to fight on those bloody battlefields, and they fought heroically, amazing of courage and sacrifice. And they sustained the highest combat casualty rate of any unit of its proportional size of the entire Second World War. And they returned from those battlefields as the most decorated unit of all of the World War II units. They were welcomed back on the White House lawn by President Truman, who said to them, you fought not only the enemy, but prejudice, and you won. But there are so many stinging ironies involved here. The American flag that covered the coffins of those that perished on those battlefields were delivered back to their wives or their parents, still incarcerated behind those barbed wire fences. They lost their husbands or their sons, and they were still imprisoned. Mm. Allegiance, that is a powerful title for this musical.
No, but we've allowed you to go on with such eloquence because this is a rich part of American history that very few fellow citizens get a chance to hear and have to wrestle with. We know our dear brother Matthew Briones just wrote this magnificent book, Jim and Jap Crow, a memoir of Charles Chukotka, also spent time in internment camps and the concentration camps or relocation centers. But the way in which the precious Japanese brothers and sisters were able to bounce back, preserve their dignity, preserve their humanity in the face of America's hypocrisy under a liberal president. This is FDR.
That's right.
This is the grand hero of the war. And of
he signed
security.
The executive order.
He signed the executive order. And it was not just illegal, but in many ways it was an act of criminality in terms of the violation of the humanity of Japanese Americans, of U.S. citizens. But the fact that you use this as an artistic way of keeping track of the humanity of all of us, there's been comparisons of Allegiance to Fiddler on the Roof that deals with the rich
yes.
history of our Jewish brothers and sisters and the Jewish
right.
family. And now we get a Japanese. What do you make of that?
Well, there's okay. another conflict here in this story as well.
Mm-hmm.
These young men who went and fought for this country are my heroes. I owe to them the America that I enjoy today. But there is another group of heroes who I consider equally American. They're the ones that resisted serving in the United States Army. They said, I'm an American and I will fight for this country, but I will not fight for this country as an internee, leaving my family in imprisonment. I will go if I can report to my hometown draft board with my family in our homes, but I will not go as an internee from behind these barbed wire fences. And for that, they were tried and found guilty of draft evasion, and they were imprisoned in federal penitentiaries.
Yes,
from
prison.
An internment camp to federal penitentiaries. They paid a high price for their principled and equally courageous position. They were Americans who challenged the illegality, the unconstitutionality of the internment and the loyalty questionnaire. They are Americans to the core. And it's that conflict between those that served and those who stood on principle and resisted that is the drama in Allegiance. Allegiance can be expressed in so many different ways, with equally high costs and with equally strong courage.
George, I asked a moment ago, and I'm grateful that you took the time to explain what Allegiance meant and shared some history that so many Americans do not know or have forgotten. But I'm still interested in knowing about your own personal story, because I know that this